I don't know when what titles have to do with attractiveness. I would imagine the more explosive volcanoes would be very attractive. And I imagine there's something repelling about hearing anything about a split brain, because it raises such horrible images of grisly surgical procedures. And you might ask, well, am I kidding? Is it split brain? Do we really mean split brain? And the answer is yes. Yeah. I mean split brain, like surgically split. Maybe I just should say a word or two before I play a game with you to make this a little bit more human. Back in the 1950s, there was some interest in beginning surgery on to figure out a connecting link between the two hemispheres. This connecting link was basically a bunch of thick nerves, which, for reasons I don't know that the anatomists had, they called it the corpus callosum. And the only way they could figure out what good does that thing do is to say, well, maybe it just has a mechanical function. That is, it keeps one brain hemisphere from flopping down on one side and the other from flopping down the other. But that's what the jokes were. They have to have grisly jokes in a grisly circumstance. They said, some of the fellows began to think, what would happen if we would cut that brain down the middle? Would there be any difference in the performance of the animal? Because they wanted to start with animals instead of human beings, which is an act of mercy, I would imagine. So they started out with cats, splitting that corpus callosum, and then they would do little experiments with cats. They'd go back to conditioning ones. What they'd do is they'd patch an eye of a cat, just put a little blindfold over it, and let the cat learn a specific thing, a specific activity. Like, for example, if a cat would see a triangle above one petal and a circle above another petal, that if the cat would learn that always pressing the petal with the triangle under it would deliver it food, we could say that after a certain number of trials, the cat has learned how to press that he has learned something, namely, triangles give food, circles don't. Now, I should say this, they also did some other surgical procedures so that with, let's say, the right eye open, the information would only go to the right side of the brain. Now, then they took the same cat and they patched the right eye and gave the cat the same kind of problem, circle and triangle. And the cat acted as if it had never learned this thing before. It almost was like a teacher coming to the fall semester and thinking, what did these kids remember from last spring? Well, this cat did not remember anything. The cat had to learn from the very beginning. And they began to think, aha, maybe there is a storage system that works differently. But the problem was that cats are not human beings, you'll all be glad to know. But that cats can store information on both sides. And they began to think that maybe what was happening here was that information that was stored on one side could go across to the other side if only that thing that they had cut would not have been cut. Then there would have been a flow. And as a matter of fact, this is what they were beginning to think. Well, now what about human beings? You can't go around opening people's craniums and splitting that corpus callosum unless there's a need for it. And what kind of need would there be? It came about that there was a need in terms of those who were suffering severe epileptic seizures. Those of you who remember anything about your physiology might remember that epilepsy has some sort of a scarring effect on one hemisphere. And what happens is that the scar tends to seep. It tends to ooze. And once it starts oozing, it begins triggering off some things on the hemisphere. And since our hemispheres are complementary, it begins to kick over to the other hemisphere and asks for its cooperation. But because this is a kind of a crazy, uncontrolled effect, what happens is that both sides begin to really wobble in the motor areas, and the person goes into literally what I'm doing now, and that is epileptic seizures of some sort. Now, there are some poor people, poor souls, who have such severe cases of epileptic seizures that their uncontrolled seizures can endanger their physical well-being. And so it then becomes a matter of saying, well, what shall we do? Shall we go into it? Shall we try splitting the corpus callosum? so at least if the bad stuff begins on one side, if the oozing from the scar begins on one side, that it won't be able to go across the corpus callosum and engage the motor centers of the right hemisphere. Okay, they did that. And sure enough, the epileptic seizures were stopped. It was a marvelous thing for these people, but good scientists as they were, the ones who pioneered this said, I wonder whether this is going to do anything about their thought processes. Will it do anything with them? So they began testing. They began testing certain ways that people bring in information into them, into their systems. Like, for example, a right ear, information typically from the, that comes in the right ear goes over to the left side. Typically, information that goes in the left ear goes in the right side, but we're not conscious of this. That happens so automatically that we make our adaptations that we're not aware that it's happening. Likewise, our hands can process this, left hand to right side, right hand to left side. Now, what would happen? They knew a lot of things were happening here, and they found out that one thing, that on the left hemisphere, and they knew this really somewhat before, but it was confirmed by this research, was the place where a lot of things called thinking take place, in our traditional way of describing thinking. That is, the verbal stuff, learning how to read, learning how to think analytically, how to think logically, how to process information by verbal symbols, was happening on the left side. What would happen if you would give a person a piece of chalk and hold it behind his back, that is, have him hold the hands his hands behind the back, place a piece of chalk in his left hand, what will happen? Well, the information is going over to his right hemisphere. And if his corpus callosum is split, he might be feeling it, and indeed there's nothing wrong with his sense endings. He feels it. He knows in a sense what it is. But he doesn't have a name for it, because the name is on the left side. And his access to that left hemisphere simply is not going to get is gone. It's cut. He doesn't have it anymore. So he could say, tell me, what is it that you have in your hand? Name it. And the person would have an inability to name it. Can you use it? Oh, yes. How would you use it? Would you shut your eyes and use it? And he could make some marks with it, with a piece of chalk. Now, this began to be very instructive. And in a way, it begins to carry over. And matter of fact, we might as well play a little game right now. A little game I want you to play is rather simple. I'm going to ask you to close your eyes, not right now, because there's always that danger that you'll drift entirely from me. but close your eyes when I ask you to think of something. Then I want you to look at me, to continue thinking of it, and then look away either to this side or to that side. Okay? Now, let me see if I can come up with something that... close your eyes. Think of one of the mountains that is here at Holden. Open your eyes. Look at me. Now look to the left or right and continue to visualize it. Okay? That wasn't a hard one. You all came up on a boat, probably Lady of the Lake. Close your eyes. Visualize Lady of the Lake. You sat in the front, keep your eyes closed, in the front or the rear or on the side. Now you're backing away from it and you're taking a look at the whole boat. Keep on thinking of it. Now open your eyes, look at me, and look to the left or right. In turn, continue thinking of it. Continue thinking of the Lady of the Lake. All right. Now you don't have to move your head, by the way. I should have warned you about that. Out of curiosity, how many of you looked to the left? How many of you looked to the left when I asked you to visualize either the mountain or the ship?
Erskine.
Yeah, well, like the mountain. Can you remember the mountain? How many of you looked to the left? How many of you looked to the left when you visualized the ship? This is an uneven response. That's about the way that the investigation goes. in the they have been finding under some systematic controls that there is a patterning. Now, I've only given you one kind of experience, and that is kind of on a figure basis. Let's try something else. I want you to close your eyes and think. I'm going to give you an arithmetic problem, kind of tough one, that you're going to do in your head, not using pencil and paper. And as you're doing it in your head, I'm going to ask you to open your eyes and then move your eyes to right or left. All right, keep your eyes closed. 25 times 12. Look at me. Move your eyes. Keep on going until you get an answer. Anyone get an answer? What is it? Thank you. That's what I thought it was, but I wasn't altogether that sure myself. Did any of you find that you looked in a different direction? Or did you look in the same direction? How many of you looked in the same direction as you did when you thought of the mountains? How many of you looked in a different direction? Any of you look in a different direction? The uneven response. Well, all right. That's all right that it was an uneven response. But this is the point, that typically our left hemisphere tends to put us, when we are doing logical, verbal, analytic things, they have been finding some relationship about our eyes moving to the right, because that is the control of the left hemisphere over against the right, a right eye. There, it's complicated a little bit by the chiasm that's coming in that feeds to both sides. But that, as we think, for example, of forms, of shapes, holes, as it were, that our eyes tend to shift to the left. Now, it may be that what is happening here, you came here prepared to process, and probably quite legitimately so, you came here to process words, thoughts, and we are very much a thought-processing people. That is a verbal, analytic society, where the goods of life very much come packaged in this kind of thing. And we tend to reflect that in the way that we do it. Even when we're asked, for example, to visualize forms or shapes, we tend not to be all that great at that. In fact, the artists despair over the general public's capacity or incapacity to process the world in terms of textures, in terms of shapes, in terms of holes, those things that make most of us uncomfortable because we don't have a whole lot of experience with them. Well, there had to be a way, some way, out of getting, of continuing this investigation. Are there distinct differences between the left side, left hemisphere, and the right hemisphere without going around splitting this corpus callosum? A surgery, after all, there is, as someone has said again and again and again, there is no such thing as minor surgery. Well, and when you come to a brain, you cannot do minor surgery. That is big stuff. Incidentally, you may, just one other grisly footnote, it's possible to remove half of your brain, literally, and more, and you can still function. And as a matter of fact, when tumors develop and this kind of surgery does become necessary, we've had people going around with actually vacuums in their head, or at least empty spaces on the whole side. It's fantastic. I could tell you about shining flashlights at one side and seeing it through the eye. It's absolutely, that is, sometimes babies are born that way. But I don't think that your sensibilities are quite that tough that you can endure this kind of grisly extension. And as a matter of fact, psychologists have very tender stomachs. So we're grateful to a guy at Caltech who came up with an idea, a series of marvelous lenses in which you could, without the benefit of surgery or the curse of surgery, look through lenses and prisms and so on in such a way that the experimenter could feed information specifically to right hemisphere and to left hemisphere. This is called the Z lens. The guy who invented it was a very young guy, But let me just give you, for economy's sake, a little bit of this statement. Because what they did with these mirrors and prisms and lenses, they were able to administer standard language tests to three times to each subject. That's what they started doing. This was their experiment. Once to each hemisphere, they gave a language test, and then again to both hemispheres together. Despite the fact that the people that they processed here were variable intelligence. They had average intelligence, extremely bright people who were taking this thing, others who were less than the perhaps average. What they found out was this. When their right hemisphere, the nonverbal side, was given tests of syntax, how we put our language together, what are the rules that put our language together, in each case, the right hemisphere, no matter how bright you were, performed at a five-year-old level. In other words, you take the brightest person here at Holden, there would have to be someone who is the brightest, I suppose, and give him this test, only on the right side, give him information that he could easily process, and as a matter of fact, despair of when he grades tests, for example, if it would happen to be someone on the teaching level. That if you fed information only to the right side, his capacity to deal with this verbal analytic stuff would be that of a five-year-old. And that gives some idea that perhaps what happens in the first 5 years of our lives is that these hemispheres grow up together comfortably processing the same kind of information. But then somewhere after five, and doesn't that sound like the beginning of school, it seems that the left hemisphere begins to take a specialized function, and the right hemisphere goes on to do other things, good things, we hope, and we're going to talk about those good things that happened after a while. But this left side goes pucka-da-pucka-da, as Walter Mitty used to say, it goes pucka-da-pucka-da in terms of the school enterprise. Now, the question is, here society has come across with the notion that that's the way to do things. And it exercises this, and I don't want to get into muscles in the head or anything like that, but society provides institutions whereby that side of the brain is very well exercised, or presumably well exercised, I suppose, for 8 years, 12 years, get out of high school, more than that, sure, 16 years, and pretty soon you find that whole thing being nurtured by society's institutions. Well, what's happening over here? Not much, not much. But let's see what is happening in terms of the last of this experiment. When they found that the vocabulary, by the way, of the on the right side could grow to about a 14-year level, and then it stopped pretty well. It didn't do a whole lot more after that. But that began to bother some people, saying, "What about our schooling? Is it possible? Is it possible to think that we've had so strong an emphasis on the analytic thought that the gifts of people are at best half realized?" I was talking to a member of this board of Holden who had only gone through his high school education, never anything beyond this. He, in his junior year in high school, he failed every single course. And they just despaired. He went into the army after that, I imagine, which was interpreted as a mercy by his teachers. And came back after the army and said, "Is there anything that I can do? I want to go on to college with the GI Bill." And they said, "You better not do something else, anything else, but don't do that." So he didn't do that. And as a result, he's enormously successful as a businessman. Extremely, extremely intelligent. But he's got a way of analyzing things, not verbally necessarily. He comes up here, and every time he comes up here, you find him after the board meetings looking at the Hobart dishwasher and seeing whether that's all right. And when that thing goes, the Hobart goes, we are in a disaster area. It's almost like our sewage system stops. We are really in trouble. But it broke down because someone was jamming in those dirty dishes too quickly. Well, after the meeting that night, he got around there, and someone said this, and he got there around 10:30, and he spent most of the night getting into this thing and repairing it. Had he ever worked on a Hobart before? Never. 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 But he looked at it and said, there has to be, if someone made that, there's a way of someone taking it apart and putting it together again. He works on a carburetor. We have a lot of carburetors around here. Does things like that, analyzes them, sits down, and does great things with them. Takes them apart, puts them together again. I ask him, how in the world do you ever get through school without being destroyed? Because in our school system, we do elevate those activities to a matter of personal worth. And a lot of other things that are worthy in the human enterprise, we simply don't elevate at all. And as a matter of fact, we downgrade. Just think of how we downgraded, those of you who went to larger high schools, the notion of vocational education. That's for the dummies who don't go to college. And yet, if we would go over there, we could see some of the most gifted of the students. The gifted people who are gifted, but in different ways. We have a way of so looking at all of our enterprises, and so many of our enterprises, through the eyes of verbal ability, that we think that nothing else is worthwhile. Check out something else. Most of us here come from dogmatic church body, a confessional church body known as Lutheran Church. How do we do our theology more often than not? Except through the verbal sieve. If we can talk theology, we're doing it. And we have as I say this, I don't want to in any way downgrade the enterprise of verbal theology. It really helps us grow. Any of you who sit in on Walt's Bible classes in the morning know how your whole conceptualization of Scripture's teaching can just take wing and soar. If you haven't taken that in, by all means do take it in sometime during your stay in Holden. It's a marvelous thing. It's a way of doing theology, of understanding God's relationship to man, that is enormously useful. But it is, in the final analysis, a way that also far may be less than what the religious experience can be. And when I say may, I say it with some reservation, because we do know that there is great expansion to the religious experiences beyond the verbal. In fact, many of us have remembered times when we've been disenchanted with the religious experience because it has been turned to a series of verbalism exercises, saying, is that all we can do is talk? The difference between talking God and translating him into behavior, we all know the difficulty there. The problem of emotion, the problem of feeling, where is the appropriate place for that in the religious experience? Isn't it sometimes that we become horribly embarrassed that we even let ourselves go on that level? Or when there, and we do have that in Holden Village too, when sometimes what happens is that we end up our service by clapping hands. Horrible. You know, we have desecrated the house of God. Like last night after the service, someone started clapping. We forget that's what the Psalms say, you know, clap your hands. I just turned to someone and backed me and said, I just love this. I think we should end every service with clapping if we can, or if we feel that way.
There's a Catholic writer who says that a great sermon will be applauded.
Oh, fine, fine. But don't we find ourselves more often than not holding in our feelings during a worship service? It's not nice to touch, for example. We have a thing about touching. Last night during the service, I don't know, I must have hugged four perfect strangers, including men, you know. And you say, well, you hug men, well, what kind of guy are you? Or, you know, check out your biology. But the feeling, the place of touch, the place of other ways of worship besides the verb, the word, even the way of discriminating between within our theology, I don't think can always be done in terms of the strength of the argument. I happen to have a background in the Missouri Synod, and if any of you are aware of the agonies that the Missouri Synod has gone through and the capacity for insulting fellow Christians and fellow Lutherans that we've developed, we have done a good job with that, and I am part of that body. But I am not, at the same time, a theologian. Yet, it has come to me, and not as a great insight, but as one that is useful for me, that sometimes these divisions may be only in the purview of the theologians, and that most of us who are not in that, that have that capacity or have that background, may have to use other organs of ourselves to determine where are we fitting. I suggest that maybe one of the best ways is to use our nose. I sniff things, and if they don't smell nice to me, I go to some place where it smells nice. And as a matter of fact, the theological differences, I tend to do it that way. What smells right to me? What sniffs right? And I'm beginning to learn to trust that fully as much as listening to the logical arguments, because the logical arguments are not going to win the day. I think we're going to have to expand our base of processing. But these different kinds of consciousness are fascinating to deal with. This is not a new idea in terms of splitting this brain. That is, in terms of knowing that there are other ways of processing this world. Back in the early part of this century, there was a remarkable psychologist at Harvard by the name of William James. I'm sure a number of you recognize the name immediately, if not by him, then by his more celebrated brother, Henry James, who was the novelist. And William James had the capacity to say so many things well. And in a book called The Varieties of Religious Experience, he talked about this notion of processing more than by words. And it's a fairly lengthy paragraph, but it's well worth listening to. He says this: our normal waking consciousness, rational consciousness as we call it, is but one kind of consciousness, whilst all about it, parted from it by the flimsiest of screens, there lie potential forms of consciousness entirely different. We may go through life without suspecting their existence, but apply the requisite stimulus, and at a touch they are there in all their completeness. Definite types of mentality which probably somewhere have their field of application and adaptation. Let me just put a little pause here. Those of you who were here yesterday morning to see the Holden slides by Sig Schrader, or last night the ones by Ernie, I remember last night was just extremely impressive. Yesterday morning I was sitting next to someone I like very much, who happens to be a visceral responder. And as here I was trying to sop up the tears as we were going through these three marvelous pictures all at one time, and the great hymns and the tremendous music. It was all coming upon us, and all of a sudden the whole Holden experience was reverberating in front of our eyes. It was going wow, 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 wow. And here she was crying, and I was trying to process it mentally and also with my fingertips. But I really found, despite my background in verbal analysis, chills going up my back, not being able to help myself. My other levels of consciousness, separated by these flimsiest of partitions, was really hitting me. And I'm sure when I say me, I invite you to check your own experiences where you felt on a much broader plane, experiences that usually you don't let in. But James goes on to say this: no account of the universe in its totality can be final, which leaves these other forms of consciousness quite disregarded. Yet they may determine attitudes, though they cannot furnish formulas. They may open a region, though they fail to give a map. At any rate, they forbid a premature closing of our accounts with reality. They forbid a premature closing of our accounts with reality. One of the things that I really am grateful for, I mentioned Ernie before, I don't know this man too well. He's a naturalist. And yet I had a short conversation with him earlier last week in which he talked about doing things and yet not doing things, of seeing things and yet not seeing, of going on a nature hike with Ernie, I understand, it can be one of the highlights of this experience here at Holden. But you can't walk too fast with him, I'm told, because he sees so many things that are going in our consciousness. My consciousness oftentimes is, well, we're going on a hike, that means we start here and we end there. And he is horrified by that notion. He says, for goodness sakes, what are you doing? What are you doing? Getting from here to there? You have an interstate mentality that says the best way of traveling is to hit the interstates, take the four-lane divided highway, and forget that there are flowers to smell, things to touch, processes to engage in. How can you do this? How can you do this? You're missing the whole experience. If you lurch also from one activity to the other, well, I've done those today. I've done the Bible study. I've done the rich Christian and the poor world. I've done the split brain. All right, now that's the whole experience. It's not. It's not. And more, the notion is becoming clear that the exciting thing that's coming out of psychology right now is that we might be able, indeed, to demonstrate that there is a physical locus, a physical source, or a physical side of us, maybe that right hemisphere, that we can legitimize, like we've legitimized the left hemisphere and done so many things to glorify it and to master our physical world. And by the way, the left hemisphere does that very well. I could say also something about this. I mentioned last week how sometimes we have as our prophets our very own youth who perceive these things faster than we. And someone had talked about older people, those of us among us who are older, and I am beginning to feel older by the hour, I think. We older people may get incensed, you know, at first about what looks like ingratitude for all the material bounties that the younger generation seems to discard. Why don't you get into buying a house? Why don't you get into a car? What are you doing bumming around? But this is what one author said that's very instructive. It may be that they're concerned not only with rationality, but with sensitivity. They're concerned not so much with making a living as making a life. They see a war of warring elders busily becoming at the expense of being, who want them to be unhappy in the same half-brained way. Isn't that terrible? The fight with nature for survival is won, they feel, which is not altogether true, but yet we have a lot of technology. And it's time we learn, however, to live within nature as bilaterally educated whole persons. I thought that the statement itself was so powerful that it couldn't be neglected. Well, okay. Now, what do we could go on. I just want to say that this kind of processing the world has got a longer history than just simply splitting brains. And just want to use a few of these words on opposite ends to give you the feeling. Lineal thinking as opposed to non-lineal thinking, meaning we can get from here to there if we go on small little steps and say, aha, that's the conclusion. Now, the best of all thinking does not always come that way, but if we can do that kind of thinking, it's good thinking, but then there is also a non-lineal thinking. We'll move into that a little bit later. Objective versus subjective. Our objective side of processing the world as opposed to the subjective, the visceral. Or this one. And I couldn't help but think of this the way that Jesus was teaching, the propositional versus the appositional. The appositional is, again, the expansion, the thing that is hooked after the idea that happens to expand it, to make it grow for us. That we are, Lutherans are, a propositional church. We're a dogmatic church body. We assert propositions and say, come on, we'll take on all comers, and whoever comes at us will be able to defend it. That's propositional thought, logical, analytical thought. As opposed to the appositional, what do we mean by that? How can we expand the meaning of that? How does that meaning apply to my own life? And again, we can remember so many sermons where the sermons were propositions, but somehow the apposition, the way that it was, the way that it took on juices, hot blood, meaning for us, was kind of off on the side. And if you reflect on how Jesus did it, he did a lot of appositional teaching. He didn't always say things, certainly plainly, but he gave also expansions of a given thought And much of the expansions of his given thought indeed tended to confuse the disciples. That is true. But like in a sense, the essence of the artistic experience is not always that you say things plainly, but that you say them indirectly so that we may grow in that indirection. There is nothing as boring as just simply a formula, or in a sense, for the cooks among us, as recipes. Those who can do the recipes, sure, that's fun, that is cooking. But those who can create them, they're different. It's a different kind of enterprise. And in a sense, that is the difference between the recipe, the proposition, and the actual apposition. Or this one, the difference between the rational and the metamorphic, how we are given images to work with. Maybe it's in a sense an expansion of the same thing, propositional, appositional. I'm not going to just dwell on these words because they are, after all, words. And they can serve us or they can let us go. Or the dichotomy between intellectual and sensuous. That I think we're up to. We know how the difference of saying I love you and really loving, don't we? Or at least roughly. That saying I love you is nice and it's important and you better do it, husbands. And wives, but doing it is so much more, isn't it? I presume I'm speaking to a very receptive audience sometimes. Or the difference between what is called convergent thinking and divergent. I'm not going to say a whole lot about this because later in this week there's going to be some forum on creativity, and basically it speaks to this dichotomy between convergent thinking, which is very problem-centered. Give them a problem quick, what's the quickest way of solving it? That is, in a sense, a convergent way of thinking. A divergent way of thinking might be, say, here is a problem, how many different solutions for it can you generate? How many different ways can you deal with this given situation? And see whether we can wing in on that. Now, I was cautioned on the first day by a marvelous little story. And that is, one of our speakers said that there was a desire to put right here on this hood, seen only by whoever is speaking, a little statement which says, the oracles are looking at you. That is, the real wise people are out there, and let them say some things. And every once in a while, you can get the mistaken notion that you're presenting marvelous things and not really knowing what you are in terms of response. So maybe it might be well to take a little pause here and just see if there are any comments or any responses that any of you'd like to throw in. Yeah, hi.
You know, as you're talking about at the very beginning, this aspect of the split brain, the left hemisphere as opposed to the right hemisphere, the different functions of the two, it brought to mind very realistically the yoga exercises that I've been practicing for the past year. And it seems to me that you're practicing on something that has been so long ago developed by the Chinese, you know, because they sense the same notion that your body in itself has different tensions and different capabilities. And let's say when you were giving us the exercise, thinking with your eyes and stuff like that, I sort of correlated it and remembered yesterday as I was doing my exercises, I noticed a difference in my left and right side legs, you know. It's a simple exercise where you lift your leg up and you hold it and you bring it down as you breathe. And I noticed that my right side always functions so much more easily. It's so much more easier to lift the leg and to hold it and to bring it down. And the left side just a little more harder, you know. It takes a little more. For some reason, the left side needs a little more exercise, a little more stretching, a little more moving, a little more work at it, as opposed to the right side. And I thought that was an interesting correlation to what you brought out about our thinking.
That has some. There are other centers, of course, in the brain that are motor centers that correlate with it. But it's somehow, whether they do it accidentally or in tune with it, is true enough. Yeah, please.
Is there any relationship between being right-handed and left-handed?
Oh, yes. Yeah, you might say, well, if a right-handed person has the verbal side and the left side, is it true that the left-handed person has the verbal dominance on the right side? And the answer is, unfortunately, no, not really. left-handed people tend to also have the verbal side on the left side. But we don't know, does this mean anything in terms of interference if you force a left-handed person, a left-handed child, for example, to be to use his right hand, because our society, again, supports the right-handed person rather than the left-handed person? Is it possible that you might interfere with his language development? There are some who feel very strongly that this is the case, that indeed there can be situations. I had a little fellow who had a series of brain tumors on his right hand when he was in first grade. Brain tumors. tumors. These were benign tumors, but they had to be cut out. They didn't want to fool around with them. But he had to shift from right hand to the left hand just as he was learning how to read. And he was a colossal failure in reading, to the point where in third grade he was still not doing it, because he was still continuing then to use his left hand. But by third grade it had become so bad that he was suicidal, a third grader. But the defeat, and the psychologists who analyzed him at that time, and this child I got to know very well, felt very strongly it was the matter of the shifting. There are some, yeah, there's, oh, is that right? Were you shifted from left to right hand? Oh, now you, oh, yeah, Carol, please.
They had done these studies comparing this kind of material about left and right side brains with, say, primitive societies, to see if there are differences?
With primitive societies.
Where there's a great deal more of the nonverbal.
Yes, let's see.
I shouldn't say nonverbal or non-rational.
Yeah. There have been some cross-cultural stuff done. For example, there's been some stuff done with the Hopi Indians, who do not have, for example, a concept of time, of sequence, that who do not have a difficulty in dealing with the difference between time and space, which is an Einsteinian kind of thing. They suspect that their capacity, their emphasis is on the right side, because it's total, it's holistic. But I don't know whether they have attached, like Ornstein has. Ornstein is a great pioneer on this. What he's done is he's gone around attaching electrodes and taking EEGs on these people. And I can't recall of any study which has done that to the Hopi Indians, for example. But they would be a good example, a ripe example for saying you can almost bet that much of the way that they're processing their world day by day is going to be right hemisphere oriented, just because their conceptualizations are not in the first instance verbal but spatial and relational, and that's the business of the right hemisphere. Yes.
Is there still that insistence on the child being able to crawl?
Oh yes.
That's an
interesting bag of worms. You're talking about a Delicato stuff out of Philadelphia. And he developed an institute on it who said that Delicato was talking about cerebral dominance, you know, and that the reason that many kids don't learn to read is that they don't have one hemisphere at least dominating, preferably the left hemisphere, since that's where most of us do it. But and so Delicato said the reason that these kids don't have the cerebral dominance, one of these hemispheres more superior to the other one, is that they missed out on cross-pattern creeping and cross-pattern walking. So what he did was he said, okay, all first grades couldn't possibly start their day off, not verbally, but by doing cross-pattern creeping, cross-pattern walking. I saw a guy do that with us, taking some college students as models, and it scared the wits out of me. He was like a drill instructor in the Marines. And he said, go, go! And he'd shout out these directions, and the college kids, you know, who were as big and strong and husky as he was, actually became intimidated. But what he was trying to do was to get them to follow directions only upon command, and then to get their body into it. Well, there was some research then done at the University of Chicago again on the Delicato method, and they felt that the success of the Delicato method, if the kids would actually learn to read better than they had read before, was simply that they were learning to pay attention before the change, and they, because they had to person up there, go, 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 you know, the kids would just crawl, stop, you know, okay, we stop. Well, they, you know, it's like hitting the mule over the head with a 2x4. You got to get its attention first, and then you proceed with the instruction. Yes, please.
This pattern, I worked with a little girl one summer that was being repatterned. She had had, or being patterned, I guess. She was born with severe birth defects and couldn't walk or any of those things. Couldn't really do much of anything. And when I first, you know, just volunteers in the area were asked to come in and donate their time to help her.
Oh, yes.
They worked with her hours on end. She went to some institution back in Massachusetts, I think it was. But they were trying to pattern her, and you would move her arms and legs in a certain pattern. And then have her crawl, and she would crawl, and they measured her. They had a big chart where they measured her progress with this crawling and how much she could do. And they were quite pleased with how she was doing, but it sounded like an awfully big job.
It probably is, because there are some patterns that can, once you let them go untouched or undeveloped, let's say, too long, there are some that are almost impossible to recapture again. They're, for example, developing surgical techniques now where they can perhaps bring back detached retinas, you know, to give a person who's been blind on the basis of detached retinas over a long period of time, maybe from childhood on, the capacity to see. But they're finding that attaching the retinas, again, giving them the chance to see, can almost be destructive to them because they have no patterns which they have developed simultaneously with their other processing ways that help them, where the sight experience can be helpful. And in fact, it becomes bad for them. And they, in some instances, they have determined not to give sight to people because in this way, because they've gone too long without it and perhaps can live more effectively with the way that they are processing the world than to ask them at too an advanced stage in life to learn how to get the patterns going again. So even, you're right, even with a child, it's a difficult proposition to re-pattern after a certain length of time. With an adult, it can be extremely difficult.
I know there was a swimming accident, and this boy had become paralyzed through the swimming accident.
Oh, yes.
He was trying to do the same thing with him.
Yes, it's very tough.
He was pretty old.
Yeah. Betsy, did you want
to... Is there anything that you could say, or I don't even know if this is correct fact that I read, but a third of left-handed people are dyslexic. And is that dominant, and if dyslexia is involving symbols, is it not? And does that mean something about the left and right hemisphere?
It would so indicate, Betsy. I think I hesitate to say too much about it because there are a number of right-handed people also who are experiencing a dyslexic situation. But the incidence is higher among left-handed people, but it's also, interestingly, higher among boys. Boys have a much more...
90% of those.
Yeah. Yes. Much more difficult for boys to process verbal symbols than it is for girls. And that comes to the interesting situation. Do we have, then, differences in left hemisphere and right hemisphere processing between men and women? Do men process differently than women? In other words, the whole interesting question of whether men think differently from women raises its ugly head. Now, there is, the women are laughing because they say, I know it, I've had to live with that thick-headed guy for so long or something like that. And of course, the men are sometimes mystified too. But there's an interesting shift here. And that is, what happens is that the men, in the processes that interest them, even though they are not typically into the verbal thing, they tend, boys turning into men, tend to like the analytic kind of thing. And even though they may not have verbal symbols at the time, they keep on working at the verbal, at the analytic thing, the taking the things apart and putting them together again that I mentioned about this guy. And that process is on the left side, ironically, where they're having the hardest problem. Women tend to use, they have found this by the use of electrodes on the brain, they find that women are much more comfortable using both hemispheres than men are. Men tend to use the left hemisphere in a larger percentage of cases more exclusively. They're more into the analytic. But women are into the use of both brain, both sides of the brain. And here, of course, we come up again with this word that we were using last week, the notion of intuition. Is there a physical base for womanly intuition? Well, maybe not for womanly intuition, but there seems to be for intuition. And it seems, however, that women tap into the intuitive level more frequently than men. Men tend to stick on the left side. Women flow a little bit better. And I'm sorry to say that. I'd like to be equal to them in this case, too.
You know, for about 10 years or so, there's been a good, big interest in jogging, which has grown more and more and more. It's become more steep. And I was reading an article the other day, and the fellow was, or whoever wrote it, was saying, you know, you've got past a certain barrier, you reached another level of consciousness, where the pain turned into pleasure almost.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And I was wondering, how do you fit this into this right and left brain kind of thing? Or does it fit in at all?
I don't know. There are so many exciting things happening in this field, it's hard to keep up with them, and I'm sure maybe some researcher on the top of a mountain in California is doing this sort of thing. But you are, now it's an interesting thing that intuitively you are right. The notion that anything is beginning to be fair game now, even though it seems like jogging, how is that even related to the way that we think? Is there a way that we think enhanced by such a thing as physical activity of that sort? And I don't know of any studies, so I have to say no. Yeah, Phil, do you?
I just want to add that came up yesterday in our discussion of silence, and it has not only to do with the activity, but the fact that you're alone for a long period of time while you're jogging, and you're able to think yourself and understand what's going on in your
thinking
process,
which is quiet.
Is the intuition, are you saying that intuition is enhanced by the flow of information?
Yes.
Is that the same with creativity as well?
Yes.
It's really the flow, not that the right side is dominating, but it's really the flow between working together.
The thought there is that we can have the left hemisphere or the thinking processes tyrannize the creative jump or the improbable, the silly, because the right side gives us the silly, you know, and the left side is holding it in check. And that's why, again, this sounds remarkably like what we were dealing last week with Jung, Carl Jung, which we'll get to, I suppose, again. But that we put a damper on the activities of the right side because we don't trust it as much. And when it gives us a silly way of seeing a solution, we say, no, that's too wild, that's too far out. But they're beginning to check this out. I didn't say enough about these brain examinations, where when Ornstein was doing this at the Langley Porter Neuropsychiatric Institute in San Francisco, he and the guy, both young fellows on the faculty, wanted to see what would happen if they would just simply put these electrodes on the brains of people and then give them activities like I gave you, 25 times 12, what would happen. Well, they saw the zipping hit, and from a state of rest, you know, little alpha waves, they went boom, 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 boom on the left side, but nothing was happening on the right side. The right side would continue to have the nice little at-rest alpha wave, but the left side was going to boom, 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 boom. Then they switched the thing. They would say, imagine the shape of your home state geographically. And all of a sudden, the needle would go on the right side, and the left side was going at a state of rest. It wasn't actually processing anything. And that, I should say there's a state of arrest, and then there's activity patterns, and then there's also a little delta pattern that means you're asleep. And I often thought it would be marvelous if we could, before anyone comes into a classroom, just fit a cap on top of their head, and then have the instructor look at what's happening with from the people. What side is he hitting? You know, is he hitting the verbal analytic side when he wants to? Is he hitting the relational big side when he wants to? Or is he getting those marvelous delta waves? Is he soon followed by REMs, those rapid eye movements, as soon as the bell is about to ring and we say, I'm hungry or I want to get out of here in a hurry? But there's fascinating stuff. Yeah, you want to...
Are you familiar with the term bicameral mind?
Oh, yes. It's the same.
Is it the same?
Yes, it is. It's two houses.
Two houses.
Right. Yeah. Bicameral mind is two houses. Let's see, we had one over here, then over here.
As I've been listening to you this morning, it's sort of the first time that I've been introduced to this, type of discussion, I guess. And the thought that came to me is this, can you see possibilities going back where what's referred to, I've heard referred to as Hebrew thinking and Greek thinking, Hebrew thought and Greek thought.
Very good.
As we begin to facilitate, or the Greeks began to facilitate the whole thought process and analytical thinking and stuff, and that seemed to become the age when that was really promoted, and the whole issue of the day, you know, if you didn't think that way, you weren't one of the Greeks and the people of the world, probably. But yet so much of the Bible seems to be written in pictorial language, and so often, I miss a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And when people that are very in tune to Hebrew thought begin to bring out some of these things, and I guess, you know, there's various things that were mentioned here today that really kind of made that issue stand out. You know, the flow of the holistic thinking of Hebrews. And when you begin to speak of when we spoke of the women, more in tune with the intuition, the flow of the interplay of the two lobes, then more sensitivity to that wholeness, that whole picture seems to be available there then, instead of just the concentration on the one side with the analytical and stuff. And going back then, if we read the Bible to allow that creativity, that intuition, that wholeness to begin to flow as we read, seems to be an important thing as we begin to pick up again as the writers who were writing it seem to be coming out of that background more than they were the analytical and descriptive.
You're hitting a very personal note with me, because one of our dearest friends was just excluded from our fellowship because he is an Old Testament scholar and was trying to say there is a different way of conceptualizing the world, but the ecclesiastical power in the Old Testament from the New Testament. And since much of our theology is a Greek event as well, I mean, we use many of the tools, at least that the Greeks allow us, bestowed on us in our propositional dogmatic way of handling things. When you apply that standard to someone who is saying, but they spoke differently at this time, yet God was speaking to them, to say, no, you are a heretic.
But even the New Testament writers, that we come out of.
Even they did, yes. But we, the body of propositional thought is basically, the stuff that we rely on in our confession. And although we should presumably be open to that, we are not, and we cannot be. Or we need the help of these kinds of people who will say God speaks to us on broader levels than the analytic and the logical and the sequential. He has great gifts to give us, but they're not always in the language you're ready for. And to see someone who is such a committed Christian and such a great scholar being excluded from the fellowship because his language, he's trying to tell us it's a different language, is one of the heartbreaking experiences I know that I had personally. Mm-hmm. Let's see. I know you wanted to say something. Cheryl, did you want to add?
It's kind of the same. I was wondering if there were activities that encourage the flow between the two halves of the brain more than others. I was thinking more of, in terms of things that I can do, I wonder if maybe writing poetry, because it uses images, but it also uses the verbal, but maybe jogging and thinking at the same time. Are there activities that encourage the flow?
Indeed there are. And they're part of the common goods of life that are not being used by the majority. They're common goods. Well, all right, you began already. Yoga exercises would be one.
The Chinese, the whole concept of going through every part of your body, feeling every muscle, which direction is stretched and how far, and yet at the same time encompassing it as a whole, that you are just the core thing, focusing on your breathing as the center line, you begin to really feel a whole different atmosphere, you feel like
a relieved person after you finished exercising, and it, I think that's mainly, you know, you are exercising, physically exercising, and that is giving you that tone, you know. I just can't explain it any other way. It really is.
There's a negative element about this, Carol, that is kind of useful, and that is, what if you find yourself trying to, and I am indebted to Larry Rasmussen for this marvelous word, if you find yourself trying to unpack every experience of yours to see what are the components of it,
yeah.
Then stop and do it some other way if you want to cultivate other ways. Like, if you bring to the flower the desire to bring, you know, a scientific drawing of it so others can appreciate it, that would be one way. There's another way you can smell it. There's another way you can touch the texture of the petals. Whatever the modality might be, it might be a contextual one.
In other words, almost every activity you can think of, which
has
might emphasize one side, could be expanded to include the other side.
Yes, yes, yes. Please, Chuck.
Well, just a footnote to the comment about the biblical.
Oh, the biblical, yeah.
I think it's not by accident that Lutherans favor St. Paul,
yeah,
and the Gospel of John.
Mm-hmm.
Both are more brief propositions.
And I do want to touch upon them. And have you, maybe, if you're going to come back Wednesday, and we'd be glad to see you. If you do, if you don't, all right, go out and smell the flowers. Maybe that wouldn't be too bad either. But if you do come back, just think of this. How are you processing the world? Do you find yourself thinking through every new experience that you happen to have? In letting that be a smaller range of the life's experiences, or at least a smaller base of experience in this life than is available to you.
Wayne, I have a question about the gender difference. Is there any study going on to try to establish whether that is biological
whether it's a cultural contamination.
Yeah, the acculturation of men and women in our society.
It is quite clear, at least to me, that the frontier of psychology is the physiological relationship. And they're coming to the same question. Is this a genetic thing? Is it do little girls, do baby girls or baby females process the world differently from baby males? Well, that's a little tough to do, because remember, they're pretty equal until 5 years of age. Well, by 5 years of age, they've already had the social contamination. You know, act like a little girl, act like a little boy. Now, is it possible we can find some parents who are sufficiently with it that they would not impose sex roles on their five-year-old child, and that the child would be completely free of sex role contamination at the age of five? Then we can begin examining this. But I don't know whether you can find anyone.
Out of contact with anybody else.
Yes, yes. Working again? I don't know. Well, we've spent a long time, and you've been very good. As I said, there's a whole lot more to say, a whole lot more to think of. And I'm going to touch a little bit. We talked about sexual differences. I'll touch a little bit about racial differences on Wednesday.